The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Coming up on Hometown Alaska, host Kim Sherry sits down with marine mammal specialist and the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Coordinator, Jill Seymour. They discuss what makes the Cook Inlet Belugas special, efforts underway to study and protect them, and how citizens can contribute to recovery efforts. And on State of Art, join me, Ammon Swenson, as we revisit an episode discussing a new book that covers Indigenous photographers from the dawn of the medium to modern day. That's all coming up next on Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Today on Hometown Alaska, we'll chat with a marine mammal specialist about our beloved Cook Inlet belugas. We'll explore the science behind these endangered whales, the challenges they face, and the recovery efforts happening right now, including exciting partnerships and community involvement. Don't miss this inspiring conversation about the future of one of Alaska's most treasured marine species. Today, our guest is Jill Seymour, marine mammal specialist and the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Coordinator. Jill, can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what led you to work in the marine mammal science field?
Absolutely, and thank you so much for having me today. So I live and work in Anchorage, Alaska, and I've been working with marine mammals predominantly in Alaska for over a decade now. I've also had some experience working with some non-marine mammal endangered species as well, but marine mammals are my passion. And I have always wanted to work with marine mammals since I was very young, which made it easy looking into careers as I was growing up, thinking about what I wanted to study, where I wanted to go. I remember sitting in front of Saturday morning cartoons, don't know if that's still a thing, and I would see the ads for SeaWorld, and I would see the people working with the dolphins and the orca whales and think, that's what I want to do when I grow up. And as I grew older, of course, I learned more about the diversity of different careers that you can have working with marine mammals and other marine life. And eventually that led me down a path to move to Alaska and go to graduate school, studying, of all things, walruses, which I like to think of as the ugliest charismatic marine mammal. They are very dear to my heart. But so are beluga whales. And after some time working with walrus and working with a number of different marine mammal species in Alaska, I was blessed to move into my current role working at NOAA Fisheries as the recovery coordinator for the Cook Inlet beluga whale.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up outside of Portland, Oregon.
So you were familiar with the Pacific Northwest kind of weather, but maybe not quite Alaska's weather.
Yes. Yeah. The rain, the gray skies, the coastal environment that we have in Anchorage and that the Cook Inlet belugas experience was definitely a big part of my childhood, even though I was growing up down near Portland. I did do my graduate work in Fairbanks, Alaska, so I got a good 6 years or so of very extreme cold, which is a good thing to get used to if you're an Arctic marine mammal specialist.
I imagine so. Was there any experiences that inspired you to specialize in belugas?
You know, I think back and every opportunity I've had to work with marine mammals has really just been, you know, something kind of incredible that's popped up for me. And so while it wasn't my intent originally to focus on beluga whales, there's something particularly special, and they've really found a place in my heart pretty quickly. I had the experience when I was in graduate school, I was working in Utqiagvik with the North Slope Borough Department of Wildlife Management. And during one of my rare hours off, I was walking along the beach and I looked out, and as far as you could see in every direction, from right next to shore all the way out to the horizon and right to left, it was just one massive herd of beluga whales. And I'd never seen belugas in the wild before. And that moment was, it was like being inside a wildlife documentary, just an incredible experience. And that really sparked in my interest and passion for wanting to work with that species more.
Wow, that sounds like an incredible scene. I actually didn't even, I guess I don't know the range of belugas in Alaska. You know, I grew up in Bristol Bay, and I know we had them out here. When I moved to Anchorage, people talked about them here, but kind of skipping ahead. But are they literally all over the state?
So I would not describe them as being all over our state. If you're in Southeast Alaska, unfortunately, you do not have any belugas by you. The Cook Inlet beluga population, and there's a few individuals down near Yakutat, are our southernmost beluga whales. And we have a total of 5 populations in the state. So we've got beluga whales in Bristol Bay, up in the Bering Strait, Bering Sea, near Nome and Kotzebue, and then out in the Chukchi Sea. And then we have a population we share with Canada in the Beaufort Sea.
Okay. So. Okay. We're getting back on track here. How did you come into your role as the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Coordinator, and what all does it encompass?
Absolutely. What really led up to the role I have now is that I had the opportunity to work for about a half decade with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who, along with NOAA Fisheries, manages the country's endangered species and marine mammals. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is mostly focused on terrestrial species, although they do also manage polar bears and walrus and sea otter, as well as manatee, though we don't have manatees in Alaska. And then the rest of the marine mammals are managed by NOAA Fisheries, which is who I work for now. So I was able to gain a lot of experience working with endangered species and the Endangered Species Act in general, working with fish and wildlife. And I also spent some time in the environmental consulting field in Alaska, specializing in the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act. So that really created a path forward for me where I had the type of expertise that they were looking for someone who's going to lead recovery of a very important species.
Mm-hmm. And what does your day-to-day work look like in this position?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it's one of the things that I love most about my job that makes it really unique compared to other positions I've had before. On a given day, I might be sitting in front of the computer writing and reviewing permits and environmental documents, which is a really important but perhaps maybe less exciting part of the job. And on other days, I might be doing education and talking with the public or doing radio interviews. Mm-hmm. And on other days, I might be out in the field conducting field work and collecting data and looking for Cook Inlet belugas. Mm-hmm. So it's a very good mix.
Definitely a good balance. Yeah. So for listeners who may not be familiar, what makes the Cook Inlet beluga population unique compared to the other beluga populations around the state and the world?
Absolutely. So out of the 5 populations of belugas that Alaska has, the Cook Inlet beluga population is the most geographically isolated, and it's also genetically distinct. The Cook Inlet beluga area is separated from the Bering Sea and places further north by the Aleutian Islands and that peninsula. And that's basically a big land barrier for movement, even though some whale species do move in and amongst those islands. So the Cook Inlet belugas live year-round in Cook Inlet. They don't, to our knowledge, leave the inlet. And the other beluga populations don't come into Cook Inlet. And they don't pass through the Aleutian Island chain. So we've got this isolated population that, unlike a lot of the other beluga populations, which will migrate from one part of the Alaska ocean area to another, Cook Inlet belugas are in Cook Inlet year-round. So that's what makes them really distinct from those other populations.
Can you describe the habitat and behaviors of cook inlet belugas, and where do they spend their time? What kind of foods do they depend on? What's their range in Cook Inlet?
Those are really good questions.
There's a lot of them. Sorry.
Yes, that's all right. So I think perhaps I will start off talking about their habitat. So like I mentioned, they live year-round in Cook Inlet. And maybe we'll touch on this later. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But they love to eat salmon, as any good Alaskan does. And that's one of their primary food sources. So where we find them in Cook Inlet varies throughout the year, because a lot of times they're focused on salmon runs that are associated with specific rivers. They also like ulacon, which is another migrating fish species, also known as hooligan. Oh, okay. And so you see them congregate in those areas as well. So in the times of year, obviously, when those fish runs are happening, that's where you will typically see the beluga whales. And then in times of year when those runs are not happening, like in the winter, they will be more dispersed, more spread out throughout their range, because they can't just sit at a river mouth waiting for food to come to them. They've got to be a little bit more proactive than other times of year, and the food is more spread out.
And is that still the primary food in the winter, is salmon and hooligan, or are they searching out other things? Because do we have those year-round out there?
Right. That's an excellent question, and it's one that our researchers are really trying to get a better handle on. Much of what we know about what Cook Inlet belugas eat comes from looking at the stomachs of dead belugas that have washed up, and those get reported to us more often in the times of year when people are out and about, which is, you know, summer and fall. In winter, there's a lot fewer people out and about in the inlet, and there's a lot less daylight. There's a lot more sea ice. So it's a lot harder to spot a beluga. So we just have very much fewer samples from that time of year. So we don't know what it is exactly that they eat in winter. We know that they love hooligan and salmon. They eat a wide variety of species. They'll eat marine worms, they'll eat shrimp, they'll eat flounders. So they have a very diverse diet. They just have a preference for salmon and hooligan.
Of course. We kind of all do, right?
Exactly.
So what is it, a marine worm?
A marine worm.
What is that?
That's a great question. And I am not a marine worm specialist.
Okay, noted.
But I will do my best to describe them. So marine worms, kind of like terrestrial worms, live in the mud or in the sand, and they burrow. And I think the major difference that I think of when I think of marine worms versus terrestrial worms, neither of them have bones, but marine worms will often have little appendages, almost like a millipede or a centipede that they use to help them move around. You know, I think probably they're less tasty than salmon. I've never had one.
Right, right.
But, and, you know, we don't know how well belugas can taste things per se. So who knows what they think, but they obviously think they're worthwhile enough to eat sometimes, at least.
Got some calories in them, at least, right?
Exactly.
Okay. What are some fun or surprising beluga facts that most people don't know?
Oh, gosh. Well, one of the things that I am blessed with is the fact that belugas are very popular, and people often know a lot of the more common facts about them. For example, they're often called the canaries of the sea because they make a lot of different types of sounds, different calls. They whistle and croak. And I think one of the things I didn't know when I started my role is that they make a sound that's called trumpeting. And I find it really funny. The kid in me finds it a funny sound because it also kind of sounds like a whoopee cushion.
Okay.
So trumpeting is probably the more mature word for it. But it's really funny to hear this sort of blat, blat sound when you're out on the water with them. And then, of course, they also, since we're talking about sounds that they make, they, just like bats, they use echolocation a specific type of kind of clicking call that helps them locate prey. So they're actually using sound when they're out looking for fish to eat. I think that's, you know, that's probably one of the biggest facts about them. And then also something that's really cool is they have what's called a melon on the top of their head. So their forehead, people think about a Kokanee beluga head, their forehead is really fatty and, you know, bulbous or blobby. And that melon is actually a big ball of fat or oil contained in their head that they help direct the echolocation calls that they make out.
Wow.
And they can actually use muscles to shape that blob of fat in different shapes to direct the sound. And yeah, that's just really cool. And it's not something I knew about when I first learned about beluga whales.
That's fascinating. I don't think a lot of people probably knew that out there.
Right? We can't do that with our foreheads.
No. I don't think I would want to, though.
It would be a little weird. Maybe a little weird.
How have beluga numbers changed historically, and when did scientists start noticing a decline?
So, that's a heavy topic, right? Mm-hmm. So with Kokanee belugas, we believe that historically there were up to about 1,300 animals in the Kokanee beluga population. So it's always been a smaller population, and that number is what scientists, based on the best available current and historic data, believe that the ecosystem of Cook Inlet could support, you know, space and food-wise and everything else. These days, we have about 330 whales.
Wow.
So that's a lot fewer. And the decline was first, I think, really noticed in the late 70s. So I don't know if you want me to go into the more detail of the story of the decline at this point.
I mean, I think we could use a general idea of why we think it happened. And yeah, like, was it noticed in the 70s because people actually just started paying attention? Or had it been happening for many years before that, you know?
Yeah, right. Those are great questions. And I was not around in the 70s, I'll confess that. Wasn't here till the 80s. But so regardless, in the 70s, scientists and also locals and Alaska natives noticed that there were a lot fewer belugas. Part of the reason this was noticed was because Alaska natives in the Kokanee region would subsistence harvest Kokanee beluga whales. Mm-hmm. They're really, historically, they've been a really important part of their diet and their culture. And so that, I think, was one of the main reasons why the decline was noticed. That's also around the same time that scientists started doing more systematic surveys, trying to count numbers of various species of whales in the state. So there were, I think, perhaps more eyes on it from that perspective. So with the initial decline, what's understood at this point is that it was due to over-harvest, overuse, unfortunately. So two more whales were taken out of the population than were birthed into the population each year. So that caused the decrease in the number of whales. And so in the early to mid-2000s, the Alaska Native communities in the Cook Inlet area and the Alaska Natives that would come and harvest Cook Inlet belugas, they voluntarily chose to stop harvesting. And everyone, of course, you'd think logically that you stop harvesting, the population will grow and it will recover. And so that was what was expected. And for, you know, a year or two, it did look like it was growing, but then it started to decline further. And so it's pretty much been a downward decline since that time. And so that means that there are other factors, other things going on that are preventing the population from increasing, and that it was not just harvest. Or at least today, it's not, obviously it's not harvest because harvest isn't happening. But there are other factors that are preventing them from increasing their population size.
What are the theories?
So there's a number of what we call threats that we've identified, NOAA Fisheries and our partners have identified as potentially preventing the population from recovering. There's 10 of them. And so one, I don't know if you want me to name them all.
Maybe just a general idea
Sure.
of what you guys really think it could be.
So that could involve me naming them all, actually. So some of the biggest ones are noise and also catastrophic effects. So if we had a big oil spill or a tsunami or a mass stranding of a large number of Cook Inlet belugas, that's what we think of as catastrophic effects. Mm-hmm. Some other potential significant threats are if there's a decrease in prey, so fewer fish for them to eat, fewer worms. Mm-hmm. Also things like pollution and disease. So those are a few of the, I think there's a total of 10 mm-hmm. identified threats. We have a document called a recovery plan that identifies and details all of them. But at this point, so researchers have been looking into those threats and trying to figure out which one or which ones are the cause of the lack of population growth. And at this point, we still don't have one clear one we've identified as the answer. Mm-hmm. And so that brings us to one of the, I think, the remaining top three threats, which is something we call cumulative effects. And cumulative effects are when maybe a single individual threat, like noise or reduction in prey, is not causing the problem. Mm-hmm. But when you combine those two together, the combination added together is enough that it's preventing the population from growing. Mm-hmm. So we are now looking into that. Well, not just now. It's, you know, for some time now, but it's a complicated mm-hmm. issue and sometimes can be difficult to study.
Mm-hmm. How has climate change affected beluga behavior, habitat, or food sources? I'm sure that is part of the threat list.
Yeah, that one is not specifically called out because it is changing environment is tied into so many of the other threats.
Sure.
For example, changing environmental conditions can result in the introduction of new diseases mm-hmm. coming into, you know, the ecosystem. And it's something, understanding what changing environment impacts can be, especially on a marine species, is something that can be particularly difficult to get a full understanding of. So I don't think there's anything specific that we could easily mm-hmm. point to. But if you think about it, for example, if you had a decline in salmon because their habitat is no longer suitable for them for whatever reason, maybe there's the temperature of the water increases or there's more silt or a new salmon disease gets introduced. If there's less salmon for the belugas to eat, then maybe they don't have enough food, or maybe they switch and start relying on a different type of prey. That's, again, something that's challenging to get at because we're still dealing with what do they eat in winter? So you can look at and take information from other studies, like studies of how environmental changes have affected other species like salmon, and you can make inferences. But as far as, you know, direct mm-hmm. links, that mm-hmm. gets more complicated. So
what happens if this population continues to decline? What are the ecological and cultural impacts, and have they already started?
Yeah. So to answer the first question, if the population continues to decline, at some point it would be no longer able to persist. There wouldn't be enough whales in the population to continue. And you get all sorts of problems that can arise, such as inbreeding and lack of genetic diversity, and just like with any other species and with people too, you know, you get a lot of health issues that can arise if you don't have enough genetic diversity and you've got too much inbreeding. So at some point we could get to a situation where we don't have Cook Inlet belugas anymore. Mm-hmm. If the population, what we call when a population goes extinct locally is we call it extirpation. Mm-hmm. And so if the Cook Inlet belugas were extirpated, because they're so geographically isolated as well as genetically isolated, it's highly unlikely that any other belugas from any of those other populations I talked about would travel down to Cook Inlet and establish a new population. Mm-hmm. And even if they did establish a new population, their genetics are different. And so they're not going to be Cook Inlet belugas, genetically speaking. Mm-hmm. So that is certainly something, you know, it's not something I think any of us wants to see.
Definitely not.
But that's the worst case scenario from an environmental perspective and a sort of social, cultural perspective. If there's no more belugas in Cook Inlet, first off, you're removing a species that is an amazing indicator of how the health of the ecosystem is doing, as well as one that, you know, is really iconic for Alaska and beloved by many, many people. We're at the point these days where we actually are starting to have tourists that come from out of state and out of the country specifically to see these whales mm-hmm. at a level I think that we haven't seen before, or at least we haven't been aware mm-hmm. of that before, which is, you know, heartening mm-hmm. to see. So that would be a tremendous loss from that perspective. And from a cultural perspective, and I'm not an Alaska native, so I think that there are probably many people who are better suited to describe this well. But I would say that I would imagine that it would be an incredible loss, mm-hmm. particularly for Alaska Native communities in and around Cook Inlet who have historically mm-hmm. historically close and important, significant connection with the beluga whales in Cook Inlet, both as a food source and for, you know, other purposes as well. Mm-hmm. So that's a loss in a way of culture and identity.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm host Kim Sherry. After the break, we'll continue our discussion about recovery efforts for our Cook Inlet beluga population.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Kim Sherry, speaking with marine mammal specialist and the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Coordinator, Jill Seymour. What is the overall strategy of the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Program?
The goal is right there in the title. We want to recover the population. We want to recover them to a sustainable level. Of course, we want to recover them to a level where Alaska Native communities can resume utilizing them. And we want to see them present for generations to come. So obviously, that's the overarching goal. Pretty simple sounding, mm-hmm. but it is not simple mm-hmm. because we are still, as I talked about before the break, trying to figure out exactly what it is that is preventing them from recovering. So our approach with our recovery program has a couple of different branches. Obviously, there's research into each of those threats and trying to understand how they may be affecting the whales. And from there, we would be looking at ways to what we call mitigate, so lessen the threat. And there's, depending on the threat, there's a lot of different ways to do that, whether it's, you know, developing noise reducing technology or other types of guidance, like don't make lots of really loud sounds in this particular part of Cook Inlet at this time of year, because that's when we know all of the whales are congregated together in that particular spot. So if you make a lot of noise, that's going to be disturbing a lot of whales. So doing things like that. And then in addition to research, we do a lot of education and outreach. And so things like this radio program, we have an annual event called Belugas Count, which NOAA hosts along with upwards of 30 plus partners from around the state and the country. One of my favorite things to work on. It's very heartening, inspiring to see the partners as well as the public when you work all year with a species that has so few individuals. To see how passionate people are mm-hmm. is great. and I could talk about that forever. And we also have a community science program that's NOAA run with several partners in the area. And we train members of the public to go out and look for and monitor for Cook Inlet beluga whales at different locations, mostly in Upper Cook Inlet, in and around Anchorage and Turnagain Arm, but also down in the Kenai. And we learn a lot about when and where the whales are from that program, actually. It's a really incredible one. And I'm not the coordinator of that program, so I don't know the exact numbers, but we're talking, I think we had something like 86 volunteers this fall, and they monitored hundreds of hours. And we get information like the earliest known appearance of Cook Inlet belugas in, you know, the Kisilof River mouth, or the earliest or latest known occurrence in other locations. And that's really informative, because sometimes NOAA Fisheries and myself as a member of the agency are asked to give recommendations on to people doing projects like a dock improvement or port renovation to make it safer seismically from earthquakes. And we'll say, well, from the information that this program has gathered, we know the belugas are not really there at this particular time of year. So that would be a great time of year for you to do the stuff that's going to be potentially most disturbance causing or noisiest. Or likewise, we know that they really like to be here in this area at this time of year. So like, we would recommend that you, try to schedule around that.
Right. Can you talk about any new or emerging science that's giving you hope?
So I think the first thing that's giving me hope, though I don't know if I'd call it emerging science, is so every 2 years we do an abundance estimate of the population. And we do that by sending scientists up in aircraft. Every June, the Cook Inlet beluga whales really love to congregate at the mouth of the Susitna River, because there's a big fish run there. And so at low tide, they all kind of line up along the edge of the mudflats waiting for the fish. And it's a very good way to, or a very good opportunity, I should say, for us to get out and try and get a population estimate. So we send our scientists up in aircraft, and we have special, you know, standardized methods by which we count the whales. And so we have new population numbers every 2 years. It takes about a year or more to analyze all the data. But the most recent estimate we have, even though it's only 331 individuals, the one prior to that was 297. So it's a little bit of an increase. And we don't know yet whether that's an actual increase, like we're going to maybe start seeing more. Or, you know, less optimistic and hopeful is that maybe the population is stabilizing and that's the new, you know, stable number. But we will get a better understanding of that as we continue to do the population estimates. So,
and when was the last one done?
So the, I think the last population estimate, the 330, was from 2023 data, I believe. And I've been thinking about that less, that exact year less, because we did have a survey that was done in 2015 in June. So we have new data that researchers are working with right now to produce the new estimate. So
maybe new numbers coming out.
Hopefully in, you know, sometime in 2026 is when I would expect them. So that's, you know, not new innovative technology or science, but it's something that brings us a lot of hope. From a, you know, more innovative or new emerging technology standpoint, we've started to use something called environmental DNA, or eDNA is what it's often called. And that's a really cool tool to use. And we use it a lot for understanding both when belugas may be in an area and what prey species may be there. So environmental DNA is basically like, you know, all of us shed hair, skin or whatever. And, you know, your dog or cat sheds their hair and it's left around your house. And that contains DNA. And the same thing happens in the outdoor environment, even in the ocean, too. So even though you might not see the hair. The DNA is there. It's floating around in the water. So we can take water samples and then we can filter out the DNA particles and analyze the DNA and figure out what species were there.
Wow.
Which is great because belugas, unlike a lot of whales, you know, they don't jump out of the water.
Right.
They're not really dramatic in that way. It can be hard to spot them.
Mm-hmm.
The waters of Cook Inlet, for anyone who's seen them, are, we often talk about the belugas as being like little marshmallows mm-hmm. in a big cup of hot chocolate because
yeah.
it's very silty water. So
yeah.
it's hard. You can't see them from below the surface when they're underneath, which makes it hard to figure when they might be coming up out of the water.
Well, that was actually going to be one of my next questions is what kind of challenges do you face when studying these belugas? Because I was thinking the silty water might be a really big one.
Yeah, that's definitely a challenge. I think sometimes it's always easier to be like, to identify the things that are difficult or challenging.
Right.
But yeah, so the silty water is challenging. I just spent the week meeting with folks involved in work with the other beluga populations in the state of Alaska. And I got to see videos of aerial videos of the belugas. And I was just admiring the clear, clean water. We don't have that in Cook Inlet.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're trying to take a photograph, because we do photo identification based on unique markings and scars on each of the Cook Inlet beluga whales, or you're trying to get a skin sample of a beluga whale, what we call biopsies, which we do on occasion. We don't do much invasive work with this population, but we do that. It's very hard because you can't tell where the whale's going to come out of the water. So that's a big challenge. Cook Inlet in general is a challenging environment. A lot of it is off the road system. It's very remote. You've got extreme tides. When we go out in our research boat and we launch from the Ship Creek boat launch in Anchorage, we have to wait till the tide is high enough up to get our boat in the water. And then we are out on the water for like 12 hours. Because that's how long it will be until the water's high enough for us to come back out. So if there's an emergency when we're out there, that creates a lot of logistical difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you've got all the weather, you know, different storms and wind, and all of those can hamper research efforts.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And of course, you know, wintertime, like I mentioned earlier, and it's dark and it's icy and it's cold and it's hard to spot the whales.
There's only so much daylight to work with.
Right.
Yeah. How do you measure progress in beluga recovery and what indicators are you watching? Is it just mainly the numbers?
Right now, yeah, it's mainly the numbers is what it boils down to. And the recovery plan, which is a standard NOAA fisheries document that we do for each of our endangered species, has specific numbers and thresholds at which we would, you know, what we call downlisting or delisting. So an endangered species is more imperiled, more at risk of extinction than what we call a threatened species. They're both listed under the Endangered Species Act. So we have a threshold at which the population would be big enough and producing enough whales, new whales every year, that we could, what we call, downlist it to threatened. And then we have another similar threshold where we would say there's enough whales in the population and they're producing enough whales each year that we can delist them, which, of course, is the ultimate goal because that means that they're, if they're delisted, they're recovered.
Mm-hmm.
They still get monitored
mm-hmm.
because we want to make sure that they continue to be recovered. But yeah, so that's the ultimate goal. And some of those numbers are a bit complicated and involve math about how many whales are produced over X number of years and what's the average.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so the abundance and monitoring that is particularly important. We also look at how they're using their habitat. So something we didn't talk about earlier is back when we had that 1,300 Cook Inlet belugas, they used to range all throughout Cook Inlet. You would see them in Homer, and as the population got smaller and smaller, they were seen less often in the lower inlet, and it's pretty common these days to hear it described as they are now only in Upper Cook Inlet, like above the Kenai, the East and West Forelands, Kalgan Island, if you're familiar with the geography of the area. And that's always very interesting to us because the Upper Inlet has Anchorage in it. It's got all of Anchorage's multiple airports and
right.
the Port of Alaska. That's where there's more human activity in that area than in any other part of Cook Inlet. Mm-hmm. So why would they go there and stop using the other part of their habitat? We have since learned that they do continue to use the lower inlet, not like they used to, but we recently learned from doing acoustic studies where we put recorders in the water that they have an important winter feeding area in lower western Cook Inlet called Tuxedni Bay. That's the first winter feeding area that we know of, so that's very exciting. And now we have to figure out what the heck they're eating there, right?
Right. Why are collaborations with local organizations, tribes, and schools so essential for long-term conservation efforts?
So specific to the Cook Inlet beluga whales, every partnership, every tribe, every community, they're all going to have certain specific strengths, specific skill sets they bring and contribute to recovery. And it's also about just the sheer number of people, whether it's eyes on the water or whether it's partners talking about Cook Inlet belugas on their social media to spread awareness or skill sets. Sometimes it's funding that our partners are able to share with one another. And so it really, you know, there's the overused phrase, it takes a village, but it really makes such a tremendous difference. And it really does take all of our partners and all of us coming together to make this recovery possible.
I know we spoke a little about it before, but are there any citizen science programs where the public can help monitor or report beluga sightings?
Yeah, so there's actually a couple of programs. I think the one that probably would spark the interest of the most people is our Alaska Beluga Monitoring Program. We call it AKBMP. That's the one I mentioned earlier where members of the public can get trained to go out and look for and monitor beluga whales. And they do a monitoring in the spring between about March and end of May. And then they do another season in the fall from early mid-August through, you know, when it gets too cold and icy and dark to see the whales. So if folks are interested in that, you know, we're only a couple months off from the start of the spring season, and you can check that out at akbmp.org. The training is virtual to get you started, so that makes it a lot more accessible for folks. And it's also open to people under 18 if they have a guardian. So we get a lot of students. And then in addition to that, the state of Alaska runs a pilot program, which is geared towards airplane pilots, helicopter pilots, and it's training them to understand how to look for and report stranded beluga whales. It's not, you know, trying to go out and count the whales or, you know, fly low and circle over them. We don't want that, but we definitely want people to be reporting. And that extends from pilots also to the general public. Like I mentioned earlier, a lot of the information we know about Cook Inlet belugas, we get from those dead stranded animals. And the sooner we can get to a carcass, the more samples we can get and the more information we can get.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. What gives you optimism about the future of Cook Inlet belugas?
So, like I mentioned before, the latest population estimate gives me a lot of optimism. I try to be cautious with my hope, but I'm really looking forward to the new population estimate when it comes out. I think we'll learn a lot. I think really what probably gives me the greatest sense of hope and kind of warmth in my heart is how much the public seems to care or does care about the Cook Inlet beluga whale and how much attention it's getting, even on a national and international level. We have a Belugas Count Facebook page that grew from a page where we promoted the annual event into ourselves and members of the public sharing in close to real time or real time beluga sightings, so people can get out and go and see the belugas, take their family and their friends who are visiting in the summer out to Ship Creek because they get the notice that the belugas are there right now, and getting inquiries. We started getting inquiries from students all over the world who want to come and do internships with the Alaska Beluga Monitoring Program. We get inquiries from documentary teams coming from all over, and just to see that passion and that enthusiasm spread and that awareness to hear people talk about Coquinlet belugas, belugas count on public media, mm-hmm. even without any prompting or any interaction with me. Mm-hmm. It's really taken off and has a mind of its own. And it makes me so happy, mm-hmm. Especially when, you know, we talked about a lot of sort of downer information. So it's great to see that, just the joy and the passion that people have.
Absolutely. So you mentioned before that there's a lot of identifiers for individual belugas. Do you have a favorite beluga or favorite beluga experience?
Oh, gosh. I mean, one of my favorite experiences, of course, is the one I mentioned at the very beginning with the huge group of belugas up in the Arctic that I saw. You know, that's a tough question. I would say that maybe one of my favorites is, so the identifier, the program that photographs and identifies the individual whales, it's called the Coquinlet Beluga Whale Photo ID Project. And people should definitely look it up online if you just Google that name. They have a whale they've named Treasure because it has kind of some dots and like an X mark on it. And I always think that that is a really fantastic and perfect name for that whale. But I don't know if I could say it's a favorite. I think they're all my favorite, all 331 of them.
That's right. Yeah. They're all like your little children.
They are.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. I'm host Kim Sherry. After this break, we'll be back with State of Art.
From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, we'll hear about a new book that showcases an underexplored aspect to the history of photography and the first of its kind. In Light and Shadow, A Photographic History from Indigenous America is a partnership between Anchorage-based Inupiaq photographer Brian Adams and New York-based photographer, writer, and archival researcher Sarah Stack. Adams is known for documenting northern peoples and Alaska culture. Stack's work has examined relationships to the land and its histories and has looked at the past to understand the present and future. The book highlights 80 Indigenous photographers from the 1800s to present day. Stack says it shows that Indigenous photographers have had a long and underrepresented history with the medium.
I think what comes through in the book and through the archives and through the photographers and the images they make is that Indigenous American photographers have been making images for their own purposes since the dawn of the medium.
I mean, can you give some examples of maybe some photography that could maybe showcases that?
Well, what's really wonderful is how complex it is. There is not an entry in the book that is exactly like another. And that is what is one of the most important messages of the book.
You know, there's never been a book like this before. And nothing like this existed when I was a kid. So like growing up as a young Native photographer, there was nothing like this for me to like resource. And so it means so much to me that now like there's a whole book that can inspire a whole new generation of young Indigenous photographers all over the Americas.
Totally. I mean, like as a kid, I'm sure you were inspired by what? Like, I know you like came from like skate photography and stuff, but like I'm sure you were inspired by all these like New York City photographers, stuff like
all
that.
All over the map. You
like
know?
Nothing related
but
to
nobody
where
that
you
looked
grew
like
up.
Me.
Yeah, totally.
And so this book is showing that like we've always been here.
And also these photographs have always been here. And they just haven't been considered in the history of photography.
Coming from the archival angle, I mean, it's one thing to have these massive resources of, you know, photos compiled on a database or in a drawer somewhere. But do you need that public awareness for it to even matter? Like, you need to kind of have both sides of the coin. It's like, we need to save all this stuff, but we need people to see it and like know that it's a thing.
Yes. You cannot understand the history of the Americas. You cannot understand the history of photography without the Indigenous perspective.
What were some of the stipulations of being included, whether modern or historical?
A commitment to the craft of photography.
I know that there's a lot of diverse images in this book, and it's snapshots of life, family, stuff like that. But then we also kind of get into some of this more maybe like art photography. Did either of you have any favorite kind of aspects of kind of the more historical photos, compiling those, or, you know, figuring out some of the more modern ones?
The cool part about the book is like, so this is a book of photographers that just love photography. And so it's a wide range of photography. It's everything from documentary to like fine art. And so we wanted to have that balance.
Yeah, that was really important to us. We wanted to show documentary, ethnography, landscape, portrait, fine art, everything, all the genres. And a lot of the artists work across multiple platforms, right? Yeah. And so we had to consider geography, genre.
Did you have like a map on the wall with like pushpins or something? Like, okay, we've got photographer here, 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 here. Oh no, East Coast is a little too represented. We gotta move Southwest or something.
That was a fun part of the book is like, if we didn't know a contemporary photographer in a specific region of the Americas, Sarah and I would sit down together and just start searching and looking into other indigenous photographers throughout the Americas.
Yeah. I mean, did you expand your network of indigenous photographers?
Yeah, we got to meet some cool people.
Absolutely. Yeah, we had a Latin American coordinator for the book, Magali Druskovich, and she helped so much.
Well, was there anything surprising that stuck out to you? Maybe, I mean, I know you're both just completely consumed with photography, probably 90% of your lives. But was there anything that maybe surprised you or really stuck out to you while you were putting this together that, you know, you thought was really cool? Maybe about an individual or just kind of maybe more just like photography in general, art?
I think one of our mutual favorites was Ken Mars out in Rhode Island. We did an event out there when we first launched the book about a month ago, and even his family showed up. And we got to talk about his history. And he was just a photographer's photographer. We'd just walk around his town all day and just make the same photos over and over again. How many photos was it?
He probably made more than 80,000 photographs in his lifetime. He was a Narragansett photographer who walked the roads of South Kingston, Rhode Island for 40 years from the 1960s until the early 2000s. And he never got in a car or rode a bike. He just walked the roads of South Kingston, Rhode Island, making photographs with like a point and click camera.
Yeah.
And then he would arrange them methodically in dime store albums with the help of his dad and just kept them under his bed, in his bedroom, in shelves, in his house. And he worked as a custodian at the University of Rhode Island. And then he would go to the public library and do research about all of these places in South Kingston. And then he would go into the community and photograph them. So he certainly had something in mind, but it's not exactly clear what it was.
Yeah.
But what is really beautiful about his collection is that he created this really intimate portrait of his community over 40 years from season to season. And he loved trees. So he would go back to the same trees days, months, years apart.
I mean, what is it like to maybe find something like that where you're just like, this is like a crazy, unique treasure trove that no one's probably, like, not very many people have probably even experienced before. That's got to be cool as an archivist.
It was very exciting. He's known in South Kingston. He was a very private person, except for
saw him walking around.
Yeah. So everybody saw him walking around, but he was very private, except for to his family. So his archive is known there, but outside of South Kingston, it's not very well known. But it was fun going because I went to the archive to look at all the photographs. Yeah. And then Brian and I went through everything and chose the photographs for the book.
Yeah. That's such a unique thing. Where it's like, well, and I guess you kind of get a peek into the unadulterated mind of somebody's kind of artistic work where you know that they weren't doing it for anybody else.
For the love of photography. It brought him joy.
Yeah.
And that's why he did it.
You also mentioned that you did some work with UAA. What was that research like?
Yeah, that was really fun. So when I came to Anchorage to do editing work with Brian, I went to the University of Anchorage archives and worked with Arlene Schmuland. And she introduced us to Henry Kaiser Jr. and Martha McGlashan Monson, two photographers whose collections are preserved in the library, at the library, and they're both in the book. And they're just like really fantastic collections, great photographers.
Brian, as you know, a native Alaska photographer who has done tons of work highlighting, you know, indigenous culture, just like Alaska in general, you know, I mean, establishing a network of indigenous photographers. I mean, what is the final product of this book mean to you now that it's been completed? Like you said, it's kind of a first of its kind. And
yeah, absolutely. It's a first of its kind. There's nothing else like it out there. It means a lot to me just thinking about young Brian, young little native kid Brian picking up a camera.
Looking
for inspiration. And now we have a resource for young photographers looking for inspiration. Somebody that, you know, that looks like them. And also just like realizing that we've always been here. We've always been making the work. And now we just get, you know, a little nod, a little light on us. But another thing I'm excited about with this book is that it can be, you know, a resource. Like all these photographers that are contemporary photographers working, they're working today.
You can find them online.
You can find them online. Yeah. Like if you need a photographer in a specific region of the Americas that are working in a specific community, like this is a resource. So like I want photo editors to see this book and be able to go out and like hire these photographers because they're out there doing the work right now in their communities.
And in addition to what Brian just said, we would love for it to be a resource for teachers and educators because we've had so many people tell us that they would like to teach about the history of photography and include Indigenous photographers, and they don't have a resource. And this can be a resource for that. And I would also like to say a couple things that I was really struck by in producing and creating and researching this book. Brian and I are very confident that in the archives, there are photographs made by Indigenous people earlier than the 1860s. John Meek, he is at the moment the earliest known photographer from what is now the Americas, Hawaii.
What time period was that again?
1860s. But we firmly believe that in the archives, there are Indigenous people who were making photographs earlier than that, just because of the pure amount of material that we saw and uncovered. And also, the photographers in this book were not isolated individuals. There were photographers across the Americas and Hawaii making images from the 19th century forward. It is a huge community of Indigenous American photographers from the 19th century to the present.
That was my conversation with photographer Brian Adams and writer, photographer, and archival researcher Sarah Stack. We were discussing their new book, In Light and Shadow, A Photographic History from Indigenous America. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
Thanks for joining us today for Hometown Alaska. And thanks to our guest, Jill Seymour. Ammon Swenson produces this show. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Kim Sherry. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.